This material is subject to copyright. No unauthorized recording, editing, copying, or distribution is permitted without the consent of the Economic Research Council. All rights reserved. For more information, visit www.ercouncil.org. Audio lectures by the Economic Research Council.
Now, this evening is a very, very special evening because John Mills has been a vice chairman and has been a member for a very long time. He's published three books on tackling British false economy, Europe's economic dilemma, and managing the world economy. But he's about to produce a new tome. He is a fantastic statistician. He knows more about economics than most of the economists I know, and I can say that, probably get a couple of bricks thrown at me from one or two senior ones in the front rank here. And he's also runs an enormous PLC, which the philosopher of the newspaper said was the fastest growing, the Sunday Times, the fastest growing company in profitability in the retail sector and the 10th fastest in all sectors, which is quite an accolade. Which he started in 1980 from scratch, nearly scratch. But he's also was a Labour councillor for Borough of Camberth. London Borough of Camden between 71 and 2006, and is also secretary and the main driver of the Labour Euro Safeguards campaign, which is again. If you haven't got on the mailing list, ask them to get on the mailing list because it's a very, very interesting publication and it does all the, you know, some pretty horrendous statistics about Europe. Not totally anti-Europe, but a little sceptical. Anyway, without more ado, John Mills.
Well, thank you very much, Damon, for those introductory words, especially the ones about criticism of other economists. I'm slightly reminded of Douglas Hume, who had a constituent with whom he fell out, and the constituent wrote to him and sent him a telegram, and the telegram read, "Foreign Secretary, go to hell. Offensive letter follows." So anyway, there we go. I would like this evening to try and put a view to you, which I think, having worked with it quite hard for a long time, is very persuasive, but it does go very much against the grain of what most people in this country think, particularly the policy-making world, the academic world, and the and public opinion. But I think it's right, and what I'd like to try and do in the next few minutes is to persuade you that there is a different way of looking at the problems that we've got with a much greater chance of success than most of the paper, the stuff that you read in the papers. And because the argument I want to put to you is a fairly taut one, what I'd like to do is to stick rather more closely to the text than I would normally do with speaking more ad lib. So let me crack on and see whether I can persuade you to take this different view. When inflation took off in the 1970s and monetarism became fashionable, almost everyone agreed that getting inflation down was a top economic priority. As a result, all the available weapons were brought into play. Interest rates were raised, the money supply was tightened, credit was restricted, unemployment rose and inflation fell back. Unfortunately, almost no one was concerned with what all these policies did to the exchange rates, both in the UK and elsewhere in the West. Compared to the Pacific Rim countries, China in particular was just moving into the trading world, but that stage was barely on any Western policymakers' radar screen. 40 years later, keeping inflation down is still the top economic priority. The Bank of England's target is 2%. The European Central Bank is even lower. The US Fed's is about the same. The theory is that low inflation keeps interest rates down and will lead to economic growth. But this is not what has actually happened. Growth rates in the West are far below those in the East, and by far the biggest reason why this has happened is that the exchange rates between West and East, which were established in the 1970s, have never changed significantly since. Concentrating on inflation and ignoring the exchange rate, however, has been a catastrophic policy error for the UK and for the West, and I think very largely explains much of what has happened over the last 40 years. And this is because it is the exchange rate which determines more than anything else what any economy charges the rest of the world for the output it sells to it. Any country with a low exchange rate, like China, will have four massive advantages over any country, like the UK, with a high one. And these four advantages are: the competitive economy's manufacturing base will grow more rapidly than the world average, and its share of world trade will rise. Secondly, it is much easier to achieve productivity gains in manufacturing than in most of the service sector, so that any economy with exceptionally competitive exports will grow more rapidly than the world average. Third, highly competitive economies will benefit from a better spread of employment opportunities, both geographically and in social economic terms, than if they depend heavily on services. You get less of a skewing of income and wealth that we've seen at the moment all over the West. And fourthly, countries with highly competitive exports are very unlikely to find the economic policies, their economic policies, constrained by a balance of payments considerations. Now, world trade consists partly of commodities, partly services, but far the largest component, about 60% for most modern diversified economies, is manufactured goods. If any country like the UK has a weak manufacturing base, it will therefore tend to have problems paying its way in the world. And indeed we do. In 2010, for example, the deficit on the UK's current account payment balance was about £40 billion. This sum has to be raised either by selling assets or by borrowing. It is an accounting identity that any current account deficit has to be matched pound for pound by an exactly equivalent amount of capital receipts. There is also another crucial problem about a foreign payments deficit. If what we sell to the world is less than we buy, purchasing power gets sucked out of the economy. £40 billion worth of it in the UK in 2010. There are three ways in which this can be counteracted to avoid this gap depressing the economy. Either consumers have to spend more than their incomes, or the government has to spend more than its revenues, or businesses have to invest more than they save. At the moment, corporate investment is low and their savings are high, so all the gap has to be filled by consumer and government borrowing. Something like, I think, another £20 billion worth of net saving by the corporate sector. So you finish up with about a £60 billion deficit on demand in the economy. There is thus a direct causal link between the exchange rate and borrowing. If the exchange rate is too high, it leads to a current account foreign payments deficit. The only way then to maintain demand in the economy is by consumer and government debt increasing. Does this matter? Yes, indeed it does. Especially if, to keep plugging the deficit in the countries, the consumers and the government's expenditure, more and more debt has to be created in relation to the borrower's capacity to repay. Provided lenders are satisfied that in the last analysis the debts owing to them will be honoured, and in the meantime interest on them will be paid, borrowing can go on going up and up, as it does, for example, to growing and profitable companies. Unfortunately, however, neither countries with weak payment balances, nor their consumers, and nor their governments generate the sorts of income flows which are produced by profitable investments. Very significant constraints on borrowing then come into play. When the sums owed both by consumers and the government, begin to look uncomfortably large, lenders get increasingly unsure about lending to them. They also start to worry about the country's capacity to meet its obligations. To stop the country's current account payments deficit getting too substantial, the economy therefore cannot be run at full stretch, because this would widen the payments gap to an unsustainable extent. A weak balance of payments position thus makes it impossible to run the economy at full throttle. The cumulative effect of this constraint explains why registered unemployment, running at about 2.6 million in the UK at the present time, is so high. Actually, however, the registered unemployment figure grossly underestimates the real total number of people who would be willing to work if there were sufficient jobs available that paid a reasonable wage. Surveys show that the total number of missing jobs in the UK is nearer 4 million than 2.6 million. As deflationary policies bite harder and growth stalls, constraints tighten still further. If any economy has a borrowing requirement which is rising more slowly than the economy is growing, like India does at the moment, lenders can remain reasonably confident that their debts will be repaid. If the debts are rising faster than the growth rate, which is now the position in the UK and much of the rest of the West, as soon as it becomes apparent that this is the case, lenders start getting much more nervous. Their reaction then is to try to cut down the amount of borrowing needed, but this can very easily turn into a self-defeating policy. The less borrowing there is to make up the demand deficiency, the more slowly the economy will grow and the less debt servicing capacity the economy will have. Meanwhile, the need for borrowing may not go down. If consumers' incomes drop more rapidly than their spending and claims on government expenditure rise faster than before as unemployment goes up, the need for more debt may go up rather than down. This is the bind in which the UK government now finds itself. Labour advocates reflation, but clearly with a substantial risk that such a policy will cause the creditworthiness of the country to be downgraded. Interest charges would then rise as the lending risks increased. An expansion of the economy would become unsustainable. The Conservative Lib Dem coalition is trying to cut expenditure to satisfy lenders that borrowing can be kept under control, but with a heavy risk that growth will disappear completely while more borrowing is still needed. Neither policy looks viable. If we carry on the way we are at the moment, at best we will suffer from years of slow or quite possibly negative growth, rising unemployment, stagnant or falling real incomes, and cutbacks in government expenditure. At worst, our capacity to go on borrowing the money we need to plug the unending deficits with which we will be confronted will lead to lenders losing patience with us. Our ability to borrow more money on any viable terms will then disappear, and a really major crisis will be precipitated. Now, is there a solution to these problems? There is, but only if our economic policy priorities are radically changed. We need to cease trying to fight inflation as our major objective. Instead, we need to get the exchange rate right. If we can do this, we can get rid of our weak balance of payments position, which in turn is the only long-term way to stop the country, its consumers and its government needing to borrow more and more money with less and less chance of being able to pay it back. It will also enable us to have a much more prosperous future. In addition, it will avoid our position in the world sliding downhill as a result of our inability to run our economy effectively. It will also strengthen our capacity to help solve some of the world's longer-term problems from a position of strength and confidence rather than weakness and decline. What would we have to do with the exchange rate to get our economy functioning much better? Some fairly easy calculations provide the orders of magnitude of the devaluations which would be needed to be made to deal with various different objectives, starting from where we are now. And I haven't brought these calculations with me, but I'm shortly, I hope, going to have a website where you can look at them all and work through them yourself to see whether you think they're accurate or not, and based on proper empirical evidence. But this is what the calculations I've done show. To eliminate the payments deficit, leaving the economy capable of growing at about 2% per annum, but with still large levels of unemployment, a devaluation of between 10% and 15% would be needed. to eliminate the payments deficit and to provide enough leeway to allow the economy to be run with a much higher level of demand, producing a cumulative growth rate of about 4% per annum. And this is all starting from where we are now, with the dollar at about 160 to the pound and the euro, what, about 113 or something. To achieve a 4% rate per annum, which is the world average at the moment, a devaluation of between 20% to 25% would be needed. To enable the economy to move over a transitional period to the growth rates experienced by countries such as Germany and Japan after World War II, or China now, i.e. with a growth rate of about 8% per annum, and I'm not necessarily advocating we should do this, but just by way of illustration, the pound would need to fall in value on the exchanges by 40 to 50%, huge change. And it's important to realise that these parity changes need to be made on a trade-weighted basis to be effective. If other countries were to devalue at the same time as the UK, then even larger devaluations against the non-devaluing countries would be required. The magnitude of the changes needed, however, is an important testament to the enormous lack of competitiveness, particularly with many of the Pacific Rim countries to which Britain is currently exposed. I have to say that part of the reason why I say all this to you is that I spend all my day job time trading right across the world buying and selling products. And even now, even despite some of the rises in cost of being in China, I can tell you, it costs about half as much to get most of what the company I run buys and sells made in China than it does in the UK. I mean, the difference is absolutely massive and still there. What would need to be done to get the exchange rate down? There would have to be a major reversal of the policy objectives which policymakers in the UK have long strived to attain. The authorities would need to make it clear that a much lower pound was not only what they wanted to see, but what they were determined to achieve. The Bank of England could be instructed to sell sterling and buy foreign currencies. More quantitative easing could be introduced. The government could deliberately increase its deficit to widen the payments deficit unless the parity of the currency fell. The nationalised banks could be instructed to lend more money to businesses, accepting the risk that there might be more bad loans. Portfolio inward investment could be discouraged instead of being welcomed as it has been. If the credit rating agencies threatened downgrades, they should be ignored, maybe even encouraged, because these would help to bring down the pound down. All of this is technically feasible, but there would be two major obstacles in the way. One would be the attitude of the countries against whom we were devaluing, and the other would be the entrenched views on economic policy within the UK and most other Western countries too. Countries like China may well object to losing some of their competitiveness, but on mature reflection, they may realise that they have little to lose and much to gain from countries such as the UK being in better shape. It is not in China's interest for there to be a massive debt crisis in the West, undermining the prosperity of the world economy generally and the prospects for Chinese exports in particular. Nor is it in China's long-term interest to run its present large balance of payment surplus, especially if the foreign exchange thus generated is lent to countries which are never likely to be able to pay it back. China's very rapid growth rate would only be impacted if the UK and other Western countries adopted very deep devaluations, which would be much more difficult to achieve than smaller ones. The depreciation of anything up to 25% against the Chinese renminbi, there would not be much erosion, if any, to China's huge manufacturing capacity. Furthermore, if no international consensus was forthcoming, there would still be nothing to stop the UK taking the unilateral actions described earlier. It may be better to achieve some measure of agreement if this can be done, but in the last analysis, it is not essential. Much larger objections, however, are likely to come from everyone in the UK who is inured to chasing different policy objectives. Politicians and civil servants who have fought for low inflation and ignored the significance of the exchange rate for decades, supported by the media and academia, are unlikely to change their minds quickly. Importers are bound to oppose devaluation, and so will all those who regard cheap foreign holidays as a prize not to be foregone. The city has always tended to favour a strong pound, as have pensioners and others who fear that the accommodating monetary policy low interest rates, which go with the low exchange rates, may adversely affect them. There is also the fear that a big devaluation will lower everyone's living standards, although there is no evidence that in practice this would be likely to happen. And that's a very important point. There's a monetarist theory that if you devalue, you will automatically see sufficient inflation generated as a result of the devaluation to wash the real increase in competitiveness away very quickly. If you look at all the many devaluations that have taken place, you will find it very hard to find a single empirical example of that happening. And I think there are very good theoretical reasons why you don't get the effect that everybody, well, these people anyway, predict. So the danger of losing competitiveness as a result of increased inflation, just as a result of the devaluation, isn't there. So if there's no change of economic policy priorities away from inflation and towards achieving a competitive exchange rate, we can expect the response to further worsening of our debt position to be exactly the reverse of what is really needed. There will be more cuts, more unemployment, and no growth. Unfortunately, however, the need for borrowing will not go down. On the contrary, it is likely to increase, as neither the country, nor consumers, nor the government can make ends meet. This is not a sustainable position. It cannot go on forever, and it won't. Sooner or later, there will be no lenders from whom we can borrow. When this does happen, the exchange rate will then fall uncontrollably. The choice before us, therefore, is not whether we are going to have a much lower exchange rate at some stage. We will. The choice is whether we engineer this in time for the transition to be done in reasonably good order, or whether, by fighting a losing battle to the bitter end, we waste huge additional amounts of time and money before the inevitable outcome overtakes us. So the stakes are really very high.
You've been listening to an audio recording by the Economic Research Council. For more information, visit www.ercouncil.org.